Center, Dartmouth Hitchcock Keene, CheshireMed.org.
Support for The Exchange Friday New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup, and here are some of the voices from the recent news in New Hampshire.
I know that the president is not on the ballot this November, but the people of New Hampshire have a chance to vote on what they think about the president's agenda. And they'll do that by saying what they will about the president's number one supporter, Gene Shaheen.
And now they won't have to face the impossible choice of paying for care or paying for rent, of purchasing a prescription or feeding their families.
Incidents in my little town alone, I've got 15 people who have been injured by these devices. I think statistically, we've now got the information to say that these are probably a bad device.
The FACE Act currently already makes it unlawful for any person to obstruct or interfere with a person's access to reproductive health services.
Top administrators and trustees like NHIA board member Phyllis Stibler stress nothing has been finalized.
We're just dating. You know, we're not engaged. We're not married. We are just really trying to understand what this is all about.
From the top, that was former Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney formally endorsing Scott Brown for U.S. Senate, Governor Maggie Hassan at a kickoff event for Medicaid expansion, James Midgley, the police chief of Pelham, on a fireworks explosion that seriously injured a 24-year-old on the 4th of July, Manchester attorney Michael Tierney representing seven New Hampshire anti-abortion activists challenging the state's new buffer zone law, and Phyllis Tibler, board member of the New Hampshire Institute of Art, on a potential merger with Southern New Hampshire University, as reported by NHPR's Ryan Lessard. It's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup today on The Exchange. We'll look at these stories and many more, and let's hear from you. Call in The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can share your comments and questions on our Facebook page as well. We have a full complement of reporters in the studio to help us round out this week's news and much more. Gary Reno is with us, the New Hampshire State House reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. Great to have you.
Good morning, Brady.
Rick Stevens is here. He's Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press. Welcome.
Happy to be here, Brady.
And Kathleen Ronayne is State House reporter for the Concord Monitor. Great to have you as well.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with a law that technically took effect this week, the law allowing for buffer zones around the entrances to facilities that provide abortions. Gary, what did Attorney General Joe Foster announce this week about that law as it was taking effect?
Basically, that the state was not going to be enforcing it until they could do a more thorough review and see how it stacks up with the Massachusetts law, which was declared basically unconstitutional by the state, by the federal Supreme Court. He and the county attorneys all agreed that they would not be enforcing it, but several communities, Concord and Derry, said that they would. And so consequently, they were taken to court. And we have a federal restraining order now that prevents anybody from enforcing the law.
Now, Rick, this came up because there was a legal challenge to New Hampshire's law following that U.S. Supreme Court decision by the same group that put together the challenge to the Massachusetts law, the successful challenge in that state.
That's right. That's the Alliance Defending Freedom. This is a conservative Christian legal group that takes on issues. They cast this issue in the light of the First Amendment, the right to free speech, the right to have your opinion. That pitted against the argument that women and clinic workers and escorts should be free from harassment, sometimes even threats of violence as they approach these clinics. It's interesting. This is not over yet. There is a temporary restraining order, but then they've still got to have the hearing. I believe it's the end of July, 25th or so, where they will decide or they will hear arguments on whether it is a constitutional law.
And Kathleen, Attorney General Foster did say that while he had agreed to hold off on enforcing the law, that he thought that because it was different enough from the Massachusetts law, that it would withstand the court challenge in the end.
Yeah, it is different in a few ways than the Massachusetts law, the biggest one being the distance of the buffer zone. Here in New Hampshire, it would be 25 feet versus 35 feet in Massachusetts. Organization or facility that wants to have these buffer zones, they have to communicate with local officials to make sure that they're working around proper ordinances. Our law is a little bit more, I think, detailed than the Massachusetts law was. But at the same time, I'm not sure that the Attorney General has yet articulated if it's just the distance that he thinks makes it constitutional. Because if you read the Supreme Court's opinion, the distance of the buffer zone wasn't really one of the biggest factors in it. So I think it's going to be interesting. We've had Governor Maggie Hassan. We've had State Senator Donna Soucy, who's a big proponent of this law, coming out and saying they think that it's going to be able to withstand constitutional challenges. But I don't really think they've articulated exactly why, other than just, oh, it's different than the Massachusetts law. So we'll see what happens. I think that we had Planned Parenthood of Northern New England say that they weren't going to try and put up buffer zones even before Joe Foster came out and said that the state wouldn't be enforcing the law. So I think that this is going to be probably a pretty drawn out fight. And we knew it was coming the second, you know, that law went in place. We knew this was going to come when they were arguing about it on the floor. Lawmakers were saying, who didn't want it, were saying, why put this in place when it's an open question at the Supreme Court? So it'll be interesting to see how it ultimately plays out and whether or not this law can stand here in New Hampshire.
Kathleen, just to echo back one of your points there, in Judge LaPlante's order that was issued on Wednesday, he said that the state has not done a good job of explaining why their law is different. As a matter of fact, he said that the plaintiffs, ADF, this Alliance Defending Freedom, had persuasively argued that the laws were pretty much indistinguishable. Now, the answer that we got yesterday from the administration was, stay tuned. We'll explain it as the legal process draws on. But you're right. They have not explained very clearly how the two laws are different.
Gary. I think one of the key points that the state's going to make is that our law has a flexibility. It says up to 25 feet. It doesn't say it has to be 25 feet. The mass law said 35 feet, period. And so I think one of the things they're going to hang their hat on for the state is that we have flexibility. It doesn't have to be a perfect 25 feet everywhere. It can fit the zone wherever it is. This whole argument became because of the facility in Manchester. And that's a very tight urban facility. And even a 25-foot buffer zone there would be kind of problematic. So the flexibility was written into the law to allow them to have a buffer zone without infringing upon the neighborhood in a big way.
And the idea that they could potentially try other methods, which is something the U.S. Supreme Court talked about in its ruling, before using the buffer zones, that may be a factor as well.
It should.
This is the Exchange's New Hampshire Friday News Roundup. We'd like to hear from you at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Another law that took effect earlier this month was an increase to New Hampshire's gas tax. Kathleen, the idea here was to bring in some more money for road and bridge projects. Does the projected amount of revenue that the state may collect each year from this tax fill that deficit in the highway fund that Transportation Commissioner Chris Clement has been warning lawmakers about for so long, or no?
It absolutely does not fill the full deficit. It's going to be about $32 million a year in new revenue. And I think throughout the process, as the lawmakers were debating this, they were saying that this isn't the only solution to the problem. It's not going to solve everything, but it's one solution. And I think what's important is also in that bill that increased the gas tax, it included that we would finish bonding for the I-93 project. So there were other aspects included in there to make sure that the crucial or what the state considers to be some crucial transportation projects are finished. But no, this isn't going to – it's not going to solve the problem. It's a 4.2% increase. We've heard a lot of political chatter about it. I think Republicans really trying to hang this on Governor Maggie Hassan, despite it being a Republican-written and sponsored bill. And on the other side, we have Democrats saying we need this money to fund critical infrastructure projects. So I think that throughout the summer, we might see Republicans continue to try and hammer this because their thinking is probably, well, it's summer. People are going on vacation. They're filling up their gas tanks. They're driving. This might be an issue that will stick. But I also think that a lot of people in New Hampshire, talk to people on the street, they realize that we do have infrastructure issues here. And might think that the increase is small enough that, you know, they can swallow it if that means that maybe, you know, I-93 is going to get finished or the roads that they drive on are going to be a little bit safer.
And it'll be interesting too, Rick, to see that if 4.2 cents per gallon more in gas and diesel taxes, it also means a 4.2 cent per gallon increase at what drivers are paying at the pump.
Yeah, and I think that was one of the things that supporters said. It's not going to suddenly whack people in the forehead with a big increase. They were talking about the average driver, if he drives or she drives 10,000 miles a year, gets 25 miles to the gallon. What is it? An extra $16 a year or something like that. So the supporters of the gas tax, they did weigh that immediate pain at the pump versus the long-term benefit. You know, the one thing I'm interested in, and maybe Gary knows more about this than I do, the split between road repair and safety. There's a component of the transportation fund that goes into public safety, and that's always been one of the arguments as well. But where does that stand?
This bill exempted that split in the traditional split in how who gets money from the highway fund. This money is all going to highways and bridges of one shape, form, or another. In the past, or up until this money was up until this increase, there were a bunch of agencies that used to take money out of the highway fund, safety, the transportation department, the judicial system, I mean, and the attorney general's office, just to name a few, as well as fish and game, and we can go down the list.
But that's been one of the criticisms to say, why not spend the highway money before adding more money
into
the fund with revenue?
To address that issue, they said, they put this little thing in there, which is only as good as the next legislature, however, but it says this money has to be used for highways and bridges. It can't be used for state police, et cetera.
Well, speaking of the next legislature, there is a lot of political news coming out, from poll numbers and fundraising totals to endorsements, and from time to time, some sparks flying between candidates. When we come back after a short break, we'll take some of the questions and comments about campaign 2014. If you'd like to add your voice to the mix, call us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us an email with your questions or comments, exchange@nhpr.org. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 919. Good morning. Summer's a time when we seem to be stopping at the gas station more often, but it's also a time to win $2,000 in gas gift cards donated by Irving Oil that could keep you going for up to a year. Enter NHPR's Summer Car Raffle for just $50 a ticket or three for $100. Pick yours up with a phone call to 1-888-805-6477 or at nhpr.org. Mostly sunny day today, high temperatures mid to upper 70s. Nice weekend ahead with sunshine, although Sunday afternoon could see some showers and thunderstorms. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and support also comes to us from Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank. Banking solutions customized to your business. Information available at centrixbank.com. And from Birch Hill Terrace, a not-for-profit continuing care retirement community offering independent living, assisted living, and nursing care in Manchester. BirchHillTerrace.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Today on The Exchange, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. We're talking about some of the stories that made headlines over the past few weeks. Call in at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Send an email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange, all one word. In the studio with me today, Kathleen Ronayne, State House reporter for the Concord Monitor, Rick Stevens, Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press, and Gary Reno, New Hampshire State House reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. The latest Granite State poll is out. Lots to talk about in there. Kathleen, a lot of attention in the press these days on the U.S. Senate race on the seat currently held by Democrat Jeanne Shaheen. But the poll suggests that voters aren't at least making up their minds just yet, if not altogether tuning the race out for the time being.
Yeah, I think there's a few interesting things about that poll. First of all, if you're Jeanne Shaheen and if you're her campaign, you're probably pretty happy about the poll because it does show that her lead has doubled over Scott Brown since April. When he first got in the race. So she's now up 12 points over Scott Brown. So they are probably happy about it. But one of the interesting numbers that I saw out of that poll was that 17% of people still haven't decided, or only 17% of people have decided who they're going to vote for at this time. So I think, you know, I've talked to Andy Smith at UNH about polling before, and he says that it's the summer, nobody's paying attention, we shouldn't try to read into some of this stuff too much. And I think that that 17% number kind of reflects it, that if forced to choose, you know, in a poll, if they're asked, people will give an answer, but most people aren't really engaging with this race just yet. So still, it's a great poll for Jeanne Shaheen. It looks very good for her. Her favorability rating is very high. 57% of people approve of her, how she's doing her job. And I think what's significant is since probably February or March, we've seen attack ads on the air against her. There's always commercials attacking Jeanne Shaheen, and it doesn't seem, at least through the poll numbers, that those are really effective just yet. And again, it's probably the fact that a lot of people aren't paying attention. But I do think she's got to be happy about this poll. Republicans, I think we saw Scott Brown's team really tried to downplay the results of this poll. None of the Republicans have a net favorable rating. So I think that they are probably a little bit less happy about this. Even if you want to say it's too early for voters to decide, this doesn't look good for them. It doesn't give good headlines for Scott Brown.
That would be the answer in a case like that, Gary, to say, well, it's an early poll. We'll just see what happens when voters actually go to the polls.
I mean, what really is impressive, as Kathleen said, is that, I mean, $3 million was dumped on Jeanne Shaheen's head, basically, and in terms of negative ads, and it really hasn't moved her negatives at all. And, I mean, part of the reason for that is we in New Hampshire have known Jeanne Shaheen for a long time, and it's very hard to change people's minds about somebody that you've had in front of you since back in the early 90s. She's been in the political scene in New Hampshire. So that's really difficult. I think what's also impressive for her was that she raised $2.8 million in a quarter, which was the most it's ever been raised in a U.S. Senate race in New Hampshire. I mean, Scott Brown raised an impressive $2 million, but she raised 2.8, which is really phenomenal. And you can talk about whether money means a lot or not, but what it does mean is that she's getting money from an awful lot of people. So she's got to be pleased about that.
Rick, Scott Brown, one of the Republican candidates, did what candidates do when they want to be perceived as the front runner in their primaries. They bring in big names for endorsements, try to boost that aura of inevitability. And Scott Brown got a pretty big name to come to New Hampshire for him and do a little campaigning and endorsing.
Yeah, one of the bigger names in the party right now, Mitt Romney, of course, the 2002 nominee. And who knows? People are asking Mitt to give it another shot in 2016. He repeatedly says no. But yeah, they went down to the farm in Stratham where 4 years ago Mitt Romney, or 5 years ago now, launched his bid for the 2012 nomination and picked up quite a bit of momentum from that. You know, one of the things that jumped out at me, I'm focusing a little bit more on the governor's race, and you talk about favorability and some spread in the numbers. Governor Hassan, Maggie Hassan, has a job approval of 60%, and that's a golden figure in any way you look at it. The thing that hit me was the unknown ratings for the two Republican candidates in the primary, the GOP.
Still very high unknowns.
86% for Walt Havenstein, which he's run television ads. His name has been in the headlines for good or for bad. There was that ballot eligibility question that was recently settled. Andrew Hemingway has an 88% don't know. Now, again, as Kathleen and Gary pointed out, it's summertime. No one's paying attention. And that sort of points out one of the special challenges of a September 9th primary. You get to Labor Day, and man, it's a real sprint to the finish from there.
And Gary, we've seen, as Rick mentioned, those introductory ads where Walt Havenstein is trying to tell voters a little bit about who he is. And it sounds like we may expect to see more of those from him and from Andrew Hemingway as well.
Oh, I'm sure. I mean, they've got the they've got to introduce themselves to the people in New Hampshire, because obviously the people in New Hampshire don't know who they are. And if they don't introduce themselves pretty quickly, the Democratic Party will introduce them to New Hampshire. And I don't think that's what they want to happen.
Define yourself before you are defined.
Yes. And so what they're doing now is the right thing to do, you know, the nice warm and fuzzy ads, and we're really nice people. But it really is kind of interesting that neither one of them has really caught the people's attention just yet. And one of them is going to have to if this is going to be a serious race.
And just talking about that unknown quality for candidates, what was interesting to me about the U.S. Senate poll is that only 21% of people say they don't know enough about Scott Brown to have an opinion. And he more people see him negatively than see him favorably. So he doesn't have a lot of room to make that argument. People just don't know me yet, which is what some of the other candidates are able to say, whether it's Walt Havenstein, whether it's Jim Rubens. They can say, well, once people know who I am, they're going to like my message. But a lot of people in New Hampshire, 80%, already know who Scott Brown is. And according to this poll, they are not liking what they're seeing. So I think that that's going to be something he's going to have to overcome, because it's not just telling voters who he is. It's changing their opinions about him is what he has to do between now and September, and if he wins the primary through November.
There's a different challenge for some of the other members of that Republican field trying to challenge Gene Shaheen. Former State Senator Jim Rubens and former U.S. Senator Bob Smith, each trying to position themselves as the other candidate in what they're trying to make it essentially a two-candidate race. But to do that, they would have to get that third candidate to drop out. And each one of them is saying, no, I'm the one to challenge Scott Brown. You need to drop out. And you were following that pretty closely this week.
Yeah, I think it's been interesting. What really struck me is on, I think it was Tuesday, we had this PAC called the New Hampshire PAC to Save America. It's a pro-Jim Rubens PAC. They do this press call and they tell us that they're rolling out this new anti-Scott Brown website. They're going to make this message about why Scott Brown is bad. And that same day, somehow what's supposed to be this day of news about this anti-Scott Brown website turns into this kind of war. And it was happening, I mean, it was happening on Twitter, but it was also happening with Bob Smith's campaign manager sending out a press release of Jim Rubens and Bob Smith going at each other, saying, no, I'm the one who should be the nominee. And that, I mean, the message was supposed to be why Brown is bad, and it turns into the two of them sparring with each other. So I thought that that was pretty interesting. For a while, we've had both of them kind of saying that they're the best alternative to Brown. They're the true conservative alternative to Brown. And I think that that's going to continue between the two of them. I don't see either of them dropping out. I really don't. I think they are both very, very committed to this race. So we'll see what happens. I think, you know, going back to that poll, I don't think any of the Republicans should be happy with it. But if anyone is taking something positive away from it, it's probably Bob Smith, because he's polling 13 points behind Gene Shaheen, and Scott Brown's only polling 12 points behind Gene Shaheen. So I think that he can look at that and maybe try and make this message that I'm closer to Scott Brown than you think. And Jim Rubens was, I think, he was more than 15 points, maybe more than 20, I can't remember, behind Gene Shaheen. So Bob Smith can bulk up that argument a little bit that I should be the one running, you should drop out. And I think that we're going to see them keep battling it out. And whether that's a smart strategy, I don't know.
Gary, when you have something that's something of a national marquee matchup to political pundits like this U.S. Senate race, some of the other races here in New Hampshire get a lot less play. For example, the two congressional races that we have. What are we learning about the dynamics in, say, District 1, where Carol Shea Porter is the incumbent?
Well, we had the Granite State poll, which came out this week, showed that that's a very, very competitive race, that she and Frank Ginter are literally neck and neck in that race. What was kind of interesting with the Granite State poll is they did these matchups between the incumbents and the challengers on the Republican side, but they never did a matchup between the Republicans that were running against it. So it's
there is more than one candidate in that race.
So it's kind of it's kind of hard to discern how that all works out. But it should certainly look like it would be a very tight race that that we may see either one of them could win, either Ginter or Shea Porter. Dan Innes was a little further behind. In the other, the second congressional race, it looked like the incumbent Annie Custer has a fairly, I wouldn't say comfortable, but she's doing okay, and neither of the two major challengers, Mary Linda Garcia or Gary Lambert, were really that close to her.
This is the Exchange's New Hampshire Friday News Roundup. We'd like to hear from you at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send your comments and questions to exchange@nhpr.org. Let's hear now from one of our listeners about one of the news stories of the day. George is calling from Moultonboro. Hi, George. You're on the Exchange.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Hello.
Yes. Can you hear us?
I can.
Okay, go ahead with your question.
My question is that I have not heard either in print media, which I have only limited access to, and I'm not online, so radio is one of the means of exchange, but I have yet to hear from other combat veterans about their opinion on the Pelham Fire Chiefs and the State Fire Marshal's blast on the current law on fireworks. This past weekend, being the 4th of July and so on, I was in a cold sweat, literally, because I am a Vietnam veteran, and I felt for a while that I was back in an outpost. And I am very much against the 2011, I believe it was, change in the fireworks laws allowing, for instance, reloadable mortars.
And thank you for that question, George, because that has been a big news story this week. Rick, we heard the officials in Pelham as well as the state's fire chief talking about revisiting this issue about reloadable mortar fireworks, which have now had, there have been two incidences in that town where people have been injured on 4th of July holiday fireworks, and saying maybe this is something we need to look at again.
Yeah, this year, of course, a man was seriously injured. His hands were injured in Pelham. This follows just 2 years ago. 13 people, including three children, were hurt in what's called the most serious fireworks accident in the state. A mortar hit a porch, I think, and caused a subsequent house fire. This is picking up steam, as it does this time of year all around the country. There are accidents. There was a bad one on July 4th in Ohio where a baby was injured by a mortar or a bottle rocket that caught the crib on fire. You see places like Maine, which just recently legalized the sale of fireworks. Suddenly, the sales just drop right off the table. And is it because the novelty wears off, or is it because there are these safety concerns? I think there could be some traction ahead.
The issue that George mentioned about veterans is particularly interesting. I've read a fair number of articles about this, that as we start to learn more about returning to civilian life after being deployed in a combat area, that this can be a very, very difficult time. It's not simply just that people's dogs and cats get upset, Kathleen. It's that that military veterans start to feel highly uncomfortable, as George mentioned.
Yeah, I think George brings up something that is really important for listeners to understand. When we talk about fireworks and should we ban them, it's usually the danger aspect that we hear that Rick just talked about. But I think that, you know, he does make a great point. And I think that people who aren't veterans, people who haven't had that experience, just think, oh, it's 4th of July. I'm just going to go light off some fireworks outside. It's going to be fun. It's going to be a little bit loud, but hopefully my neighbors aren't going to mind.
It's a free country.
And people don't necessarily think, oh, well, what if, you know, there is somebody in my neighborhood who might be a veteran and this is really, this is going to affect them in a negative way. I mean, we had George say he was in a cold sweat listening to these go off. And so I think that it's important to at least raise awareness of that this is something that can bother veterans. And I think that it's great that George called in and brought up that point, because it's kind of, I think, lost in the discussion when we talk about danger of the fireworks, which is also a very important thing to talk about.
Gary, some states have banned consumer fireworks.
They have. I mean, New Hampshire's a kind of a bit of a rarity in terms of what it allows people to buy. And New Hampshire used to be pretty strict itself, but it's been getting a little bit more lenient in terms of what people could purchase. And then in 2011, it really opened up. They did a lot of. They just really let an awful lot of fireworks in that most states just won't let in. And what we heard, I mean, I've been around New Hampshire for a long time, and I don't remember the kind of private fireworks that you this year. Like, it was incredible. Every time you went out for about a week, there was somebody shooting fireworks off. And I just don't remember that. I mean, I just wonder where these people get all this money to waste like that, personally.
George, thank you so much for your call. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email to exchange@nhpr.org. Rick, on a slightly related point, we had an event yesterday that Governor Maggie Hassan took part in, and Chief Justice Linda Delanus taking part in a new kind of court in Nashua that helps with criminal cases involving military veterans. And that's something new for this state.
It is. It's not new nationally. The so-called Veterans Court has begun to emerge in other places. I think Buffalo, New York may have been the first place in the country to do it a few years ago. It trains judges, prosecutors, and defenders all to work with some of the issues that are peculiar to – or particular, rather, to veterans, combat veterans and non-combat veterans alike. You know, we hear a lot about veteran homelessness and joblessness and veteran substance abuse. And so those are the kinds of issues that can land veterans in trouble. And in the legal system, the idea is not to punish but to try and help these veterans through the system in a way that is more equitable to them.
Kathleen.
Yeah, I actually – kind of unrelated to veterans, but I think we're starting to see more of these types of specialized courts pop up. I know that there was an effort this year in the legislature to pass a bill that would allow municipalities to establish mental health courts. So I think that, you know, we see juvenile courts, courts for veterans, courts for people suffering from mental illness. I think that we are starting to see that kind of expand, these specialized courts that take into account other factors that may play into why somebody committed the crime that they did and focus a little bit more on rehabilitation than punishment. So I think we're going to see that continue to grow.
And at the same time, Gary, there is this move in some of the elements of the judicial system to move to electronic filing and rather than everything being on paper. So we have a lot of change in the judicial system of New Hampshire right now.
Yeah, I mean, several years ago, we did this huge revamp where we took in the probate court and the district courts and put them all together into the circuit court. And that was the first real change, significant change like that in the court system in a long time. And coupled with that is this real push to the e-filing. We're going into the electronic filing and get rid of all the paper. And everybody's trying to – one of the things is that so many more people are doing pro se work. They're doing their own – they're being their own attorneys. And it's made a real problem for the courts, and so they're trying to streamline things to make it easier for people to use the courts in an effective way.
And there are pilot programs going on right now, but if those should work out, then we're likely to see more of that going forward.
Much more
ahead on that. And there's much more ahead here on the Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. After a short break, we'll take more of your calls and questions. We'll also look at one of the big issues in the news this week, the DMV temporarily banning new vanity license plates. We'll take a look at that and much more when The Exchange returns here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is New Hampshire Public Radio, 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, President Obama asked Congress for nearly $4 billion to address the border crisis, and the House and Senate moved to renew the Highway Trust Fund. Then fighting escalates between Israel and Hamas. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
This morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from your listeners, and support also comes to us from the City of Claremont. Information about Claremont's economic development initiatives and business relocation at ClaremontNH.com. And Rothweichel Dental Care in Bedford, comprehensive family and cosmetic dentistry, devoted to restoring and enhancing the natural beauty of your smile. Information at RothweichelDentalCare.com. It's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. Today, it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. You can join us by calling in at 1-800-892-6477. Again, that's 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can find us on Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And before we dive back into this week's news, I did want to note that this week, Laura Kanoy and the Exchange team headed to Bethlehem, New Hampshire for a special program, a live event in Bethlehem, talking about the economies and the main streets north of the Notches. That took place last night. And we have the audio of that conversation available on NHPR.org. If you'd like to take a listen again, that's at NHPR.org. Let's take a look now again at some of the news of the week. Gary Reno is with us, New Hampshire State House reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. Kathleen Ronayne, State House reporter for the Concord Monitor, and Rick Stevens, Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press. Kathleen, enrollment is now open for Medicaid expansion. Governor Hassan held a kickoff event July 1st. What's happening now with Medicaid expansion in New Hampshire?
Well, I think now is when we're finally going to get a chance to see, do we hit that 50,000 enrolled estimate that lawmakers had been throwing out? Do we get more people? Do we get less people? I think if we end up getting more people than that, it's going to be interesting. And, you know, we know it's 100% federally funded, so we also are waiting to see about some of the waivers because our plan is a little bit different than some other states. The goal isn't to ultimately keep people on Medicaid, but to move them, use the Medicaid dollars to move them onto private insurance. So we are still waiting for a few of the waivers to come out, waiting to see how many people sign up for this. I think that it's been in the news a lot. I know there's been a lot of outreach and efforts to get people to sign up. And an interesting story that NHPR actually did this week was through June, so before the enrollment period for the new Medicaid expansion started July 1st, I think from January to June, 11,000 new people signed up for Medicaid in New Hampshire, which was more, it was a higher number than anyone had really been expecting. And I think the NHPR story said that some of that might have been due to all of this attention around Medicaid expansion. So it actually is putting a little bit of a crunch, I think, on the budget for the Department of Health and Human Services, because it was before that July 1st deadline that puts people on Medicaid with the federal dollars. DHHS is already running a budget shortfall. I think it's somewhere around $37 million. So this put an extra crunch on them. And I think this kind of shows that maybe there is a pretty high demand out there for people who are eligible for Medicaid that need health care. And are we going to continue to see really high numbers now that the Medicaid expansion enrollment is open?
Rick, as Health and Human Services Commissioner Nick Tumpas put it, he said, the good news is that we're able to reach out to people who need health insurance. The challenging part is that there's a cost that comes with that, and we have to find the money.
Well, sure. And the word challenge with healthcare over the last year has certainly been used a lot. I wanted to amplify a point that Kathleen made about the enrollment numbers, and it will be a numbers game. We remember during the rollout of the Affordable Care Act, everyone had a target for enrollment, and those numbers were exceeded. I think they were looking for 7 million. They got 8 million into the ACA. And what we were learning from the folks at Health and Human Services is that those growing pains and the familiarity with healthcare.gov turned consumers into a little bit more savvy consumers. They're able to navigate these web portals. So we may see a pretty good number of people enroll in the Medicaid expansion just because of the experience that they've had trying to get healthcare through the exchanges on healthcare.gov.
Well, we have a couple of things going on here. Right now, we're talking about the HIP program, which is going to start earlier than actually the Medicaid expansion, the large part of the Medicaid expansion. But the HIP program is the health insurance premium program, which is basically if you have health insurance from your employer and you qualify for Medicaid, the state or federal government actually will be paying the premium of it if it's providing that it's basically about the same cost as it would if you went into the Medicaid program. They expected to get this program up and running quickly. They actually expected to get it up and running before July 1st. But it's going to be going out now to about September 1st. So this is the first part of it. The second part of it, which is the moving people actually onto the current Medicaid program, which is a managed care program run by two private managed care companies.
It had been three, and then one announced it was dropping out.
And that will be a little later, and we still need to get permission to do that from the federal government. And the final phase will kick in when we get if and when we get a waiver from the federal government to put these people through the exchange. And putting people through the exchange is why we have 11,000 people we weren't expecting, because when you do that, the way the exchange was set up, when you filed your information, if you qualified for Medicaid, then you got kicked right over to Medicaid. So that was part of the reason that we have all these people that we didn't really expect, which is called the woodwork effect, which everybody has been worried about. When we start talking about Medicaid, there are going to be people coming out of the woodwork and signing up, and sure enough, they are.
I'm going to tap into your inner policy wonk for one more question here on healthcare, Gary, because there was a national survey this week that looked at how doctors were prescribing drugs known as opioids like oxycodone. What was the news in this state?
Well, we have a very high rate of prescribing long-term high dosage of opioids. We're up fairly high in the number of prescriptions we write, but most of the really high prescription states are down south. But we tend to be, in New Hampshire, tend to write very long prescriptions for opioids and very high dosage, and we're right up near the top in that respect. And what's interesting is we just started a program which collects data on prescription drugs such as that so that people can't go prescription shopping, as they say. And after years and years and years of trying to get the program passed, I think we're the last state in the union to do it, we finally got it through, and its program is just about to start to get up and running.
And, Rick, at the same time, New Hampshire is one of several New England states that have said, we're going to address this as a region. We're going to try and work together and coordinate our activity so that we can avoid that doctor shopping that Gary was mentioning.
Sure, and the numbers, and again, they're prescription rates. This isn't directly correlated to a drug abuse problem, although it is widely recognized that opioid abuse, heroin abuse, prescription drug abuse is on the rise. And you're right, the New England states have decided to share information and strategies and tactics. Of course, Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin had the just extraordinary moment of dedicating his entire state of the state address to the issue of opiate abuse. So I think you will see a regional approach to the issue.
Let's take another look at a big issue that's been in the news lately. Kathleen, the Department of Motor Vehicles has, for the time being, put a ban on vanity license plates. This is maybe not as heavy-hitting as prescription opioid abuse, but it's certainly gotten a lot of conversation started. What exactly happened for those who don't remember?
Yeah, well, a lot of this stemmed from there was a man who wanted to make his license plate say cops lie. And I think that the DMV told him that he couldn't do it. So I think that he ended up taking them to court to say that he should, you know, be able to have this license plate. And what the court ruled is that the existing law for New Hampshire vanity plates is too vague and it needs to be revamped because it's not clear what counts as offensive and what doesn't. I think that what the law reads is that you can't have anything that a reasonable person would find offensive to good taste. And what the court said is, well, what does good taste really mean? How do we evaluate that? Everybody has different opinions. And with such a vague law, we might have some municipalities that are interpreting that in a much stricter way and saying that you can't have things like a cop's lie or maybe whatever other message that you might want to have as your license plate. So the DMV has said, we're going to temporarily suspend vanity license plates until we can figure this out and make sure we have something that's a little bit more fair and transparent and easy to understand in our law. And I think, you know, just talking about vanity license plates, one of the first things I noticed when I moved to New Hampshire from New York was there are so many vanity license plates here. And everyone from outside of New Hampshire who comes to visit me, they say the same thing. Everywhere you drive, you see a vanity license plate. I've never seen that anywhere else. So it's a very popular thing here in New Hampshire, which is, I think, why this story about this cop's lie license plate and this ban on vanity license, temporary ban on vanity license plates, is getting so much attention, because that's a big New Hampshire thing. I don't know what it is. I don't know why everyone needs their vanity plates, but I always enjoy, you know, driving down the street trying to figure out what some of them mean that are a little less obvious. And I think, you know, we see a lot of interesting ones here. So we definitely want a law that is a little more easy to interpret so people can get whatever vanity license plates they want without, you know, their various local officials saying, no, you can't have that one.
I think there was a piece in the Nashua Telegraph, Rick, this week looking at some of the applications that were rejected and some of the, unfortunately, we can't bring them up on radio, but there were some really interesting attempts to try and circumvent some obvious red flags that would have been caught by officials. And some fairly humorous ones as well.
This is my favorite story of the week. It really is. And Kathleen, I moved here from New York a year ago, and I had exactly the same experience. And the thing that I love, my rule for vanity plates is, if I can't figure it out, you shouldn't have it on your car. And the folks in New Hampshire are great. They're creative. They're smart. I can figure them almost all out. So, oh, one little side note, too. The gentleman who started this, he's legally changed his name to Human, and I believe he's filed paper to run for the House. House or Senate?
State House. For the House. Run for state rep from
so
Rochester.
Who knows? Maybe there'll be some legislation coming out of the House in the next cycle.
I suppose we'll be able to spot his car at campaign events, if nothing else. Gary, we have heard a few people suggest, look, there's no way for the state to avoid weighing in on free expression at some level, so why not just do away with vanity plates altogether? It doesn't sound like there's going to be a whole lot of support for that, given how many license plates there are out there.
Well, you talk about typically New Hampshire vanity plates, but, you know, typically New Hampshire, we get more money for vanity plates than we get for regular plates. So we're going to have vanity plates. There's no question about that. We raise money in very different ways in New Hampshire, you know. So I don't think there's going to be any possibility that vanity plates will be disappearing from the state. I mean, what's also interesting is, you know, that we have vanity plates, but we also have low-digit plates. And low-digit plates, one- or two-digit plates, three-digit plates, means that you're politically connected. So that's like the other side of vanity plates. But those you don't get charged extra for those.
There's a great book in it for somebody who wants to take a look at the history of license plates in this state and the culture around them. Rick, I wanted to ask about the University System of New Hampshire offering to extend its tuition freeze for another 2 years. What are we hearing about that going forward?
Well, they have proposed a tuition freeze down at the main campus in Durham. That would keep the tuition at $13,670. Now, that's an amount that had increased 45% since 2008-09 academic year, and it's among the nation's highest for a four-year public school. Look, this is not a new issue anywhere. Tuition, as we all know, higher education is getting expensive, almost unaffordable for many people. And so this is a way to, at the same time, not only make it easier for people to go to school, but keep the schools viable because, look, they need students or else they don't exist. We're not alone. Maryland in 2007 instituted a four-year tuition freeze. Wisconsin, I think 2 years ago, did the same thing. They extended a tuition freeze from 2 to 4 years. This is becoming a national issue that really challenges the university systems and the folks who have to pay for education.
You certainly don't want to be the university that costs more than everybody else. So being able to say we have a tuition freeze, Kathleen, is a lot more appealing prospect for administrators.
Yeah, it definitely is.
Not to mention students.
Well, and if for students and especially parents who might be paying for those students to go to college, I think that there is something a little bit enticing or makes you feel a little bit better knowing that the rate that you pay when you go in your freshman year is going to be the same rate you're paying senior year. So you're not going to be subject to any type of, you know, unknown jump or increase in tuition. I think a lot of universities go up like 4%, 5%, 6% every year, which when you're talking about thousands of dollars, that's a significant amount of money to add on. Like Rick said, the UNH tuition has gone up by 45% just since the 2008-2009 school year. That's a really significant jump. So I do think that it, you know, would make people the costs are still high, of course, but make people a little bit more at ease knowing that, okay, I'm going to go into school and I'm not going to see any raises in my tuition for the next 4 years, especially given that UNH's tuition is so high compared to other public colleges in other states. I think that could be a very important move for them.
And Gary, the change is not limited just to state schools. We got the news this week that Mount Washington College is going to be closing two of its facilities and keeping consolidating all of its operations into its one campus now in Manchester. So talk about the changes in the legal system and the healthcare system, education, especially higher education, right up there too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's getting so expensive now, higher education, and everybody's leaving college with these debts that equivalent to a mortgage almost. So colleges are finding it very difficult to attract students and keep students. And, I mean, we see that too with the merger of the New Hampshire New Hampshire College, which is now Southern New Hampshire University, and the New Hampshire Institute of Art. I mean, it's just all over the place. We're seeing all this sort of activity where we're merging schools, adjoining other schools, and it's a way of being more efficient, obviously, to reduce costs, the backroom costs, so on. But it's obviously a very volatile situation in terms of the industry and its viability right now.
Well, before we wrap up the hour, I wanted to ask each of you what news stories you're going to be following in the coming week or the coming weeks. I'll start with you, Rick.
Take a look. I had a great interview yesterday up in the White Mountain National Forest where they're restoring a 90-year-old guard station cabin. It's a real vestige of the old days, and it's a really neat project. It's a volunteer crew, and they take a great approach. They do this with period tools and period materials. So it's take a look for that Monday or Tuesday.
All right, Kathleen.
I'm just going to continue to follow some of the exciting races that we have going on here, the U.S. Senate race, the primary, see if the Jim Rubens and Bob Smith sparring continues and see how people are reacting now that these poll numbers came out. So just continuing to track a lot of the interesting races here.
And Gary Reno.
And I'm be following a lot of the politics, too. I've spent most of my week in Manchester with candidates that have come in for interviews, and I got a few more next week. So it's turning into the political season, even though nobody's listening.
the people may be at the beach, but the politics goes on. So yes. I noticed none of you made NASCAR predictions for this weekend at the Speedway.
It'll be crowded.
I probably take that bet. Well, thanks so much to each of you for coming in. Gary Reno, always great to have you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Gary Reno, the New Hampshire State House reporter for the Union Leader and New Hampshire Sunday News. Rick Stevens, great to have you as well.
Happy to be here.
That's Rick Stevens, Northern New England correspondent for the Associated Press. And Kathleen Ronayne, great to have you.
Thanks for having me, Brady.
It's Kathleen Ronayne, State House reporter for the Concord Monitor. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our intern is Renee Taylor. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Brady Carlson, in for Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Next week on The Exchange, a conversation with Dartmouth College's new president, Philip Hanlon. We'll talk about recent controversies as well as accomplishments. Also, we'll check in with our Sky Guys, who will fill us in on summertime astrological events. Later, a look at some of the research around stress, from causes to cures, and then it's our Friday New Hampshire News Roundup. Send us your thoughts by email or Facebook and join us all next week for The Exchange, every morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show next at 10 on New Hampshire Public Radio. Mostly sunny for today, highs mid to upper 70s. For tomorrow, sunshine, highs low to mid 80s. Sunday, partly sunny in the morning, clouding up in the afternoon. Chance of showers and thunderstorms, highs upper 70s to mid 80s. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Downs Racklin Martin, offering statewide trust and estate services with attorneys Tom Shatari, Jake Wheeler, and Wilhelmine Digmans Miller. Information at drm.com. And Centrix Bank. See beyond with Centrix Bank, providing complete business banking services to small to medium-sized businesses in New Hampshire. Information at centrixbank.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord 89.1.
WEVS Nashua 88.3.
WEVH Hanover 91.3.
WEVN Keene 90.7.
WEVC Gorham 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Diane Rehm. The Senate considers emergency funding to address a surge of child migrants crossing the U.S. border. Republicans say they want to change the law to make deportations easier. On a trip to Texas, President Obama declined to visit the border.